Hello, this is Tom Campbell, host of a series of interviews with local band members and music industry professionals from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Today's interview is with Bill Miller from The Accents. Hello, this is Tom Campbell. Today is September 1st, 2012, and I'm talking with Bill Miller from The Accents. Bill, if you don't mind, would you please state your full name, your date of birth, and your hometown, please?
Bill Miller, or William Curtis Miller. 3/11/46, and I don't feel a day over 90. And my hometown is Columbus, Ohio.
When did you move to Minneapolis?
Sometime just before junior high school.
Where did you wind up here in town? What part of town?
Richfield.
And what's your earliest recollection of playing in a band, your very first band?
A band in junior high school in which Harry Nils was the drummer.
Did they have a name?
The Vocaleros, oddly enough. Amazing, I can remember that.
And what did you play, Bill?
Piano, I think. Yes, piano.
And what about after that band?
I got into a succession of bands. The Royal Vagabonds for a year or more, did a lot of work with Mike Wagner and the Bops when they needed a fifth man. And then in 63, roughly, we began The Accents.
Let's get a little history on these early bands you were in before The Accents. How old were you in the Vagabonds, and what was the time frame?
The Vagabonds, I joined as a sax player, a piano player, in 1960, and was with them for a year, perhaps a little more.
Okay, so that brings us into 1961, and that's when you work with Mike Wagner then?
That's when I first got the call from Mike, where the Musicians Union, who was just a little bit less powerful than the Auto Workers Union, had a requirement for a number of clubs, albeit Prom on the Midway or Mr. Lucky's or whatever the club might be, where they had a five-man minimum, and Mike had a four-piece band, and he would call me and go, "Hey, come on out."
What did you have to do to join the Musicians Union at that time?
Pay them money for absolutely nothing.
So, Bill, how did The Accents originally come together, and who were the members?
Skip Dolan, Tom Nystrom, and Ken Sand. Through some bizarre process of osmosis, we found each other. And I think that actually began when I met them through a band called Damon Lee and the Diablos and was doing a little bit of jobbing with them and some jamming. And we decided that the four of us would put the band together. The three of them went to school in Bloomington. I went to Richfield, and that's how it happened.
Where did the band practice?
My house, my parents' house.
Basement or garage?
A living room. And my father was responsible for building a cauldron of chili. And we would literally hunker down for the weekend. They'd come over Friday after school, sleeping bags in the living room if necessary, if they didn't want to drive home. We just ate chili for two or three days and learned songs.
At that point in time, what other local bands had you been out to see play live?
There weren't a lot of other bands locally. There was, I was with a band called Mike Gleeden and the Rhythm Kings for a few months. Okay. No idea what I played with them. But other than the Royal Vagabonds, Mike Gleeden and the Rhythm Kings, Mike Wagner and the Bobs, there was just not a plethora of local bands. There was Jules Herman, there were the big bands, and then this little smattering of rock and roll bands, or what was to become rock and roll.
Who came up with the name The Accents?
I don't really remember, but we were trying to think of musical terms, and I remember at some point either I said or someone said, "Well, you know, in written music there's a sign called the accent sign." And I said, you know, for lack of, I mean, in retrospect, I don't think it was a terribly creative name. The Accents, the Enderbeats, and the Ivanis, the three bands that gelled into what became very quickly the next genre of rock bands in town, I believe all germinated about the same time.
This is the start of the teen dance era, correct?
It was, yes, terrific.
And just for the record, who played what in the Accents?
Skip Dolan on bass, Kenny Sand on guitar, Tom Nystrom on drums and lead vocal, and I played piano.
And all three of you sang backup vocals then?
Oh, the three of us other than Tom. Even Tom would occasionally take a backup part if we wanted to throw a song to somebody else.
Oh, okay. What were some of the early places the Accents played in 1963?
Certainly the prom on the Midway, Mr. Lucky's on Lake and Nicollet, the Marion Ballroom in Bloomington, a myriad of places around town that were running. Oh, and a great little place downtown called, was it the Marigold?
The Marigold Ballroom?
Yes. I remembered. That was always a fun gig. And we used to play Dayton's Top 10 Club up in the 8th floor auditorium.
What songs were the Accents playing right off the bat?
What they now refer to as cover tunes. It's the songs that you heard on the radio.
Did you listen to WDGY or KDWB?
Oh, WDGY.
How did you come into contact with George Garrett, the record producer?
I remember there was a guy, Tony Kyre, who actually quite a musician in his own right, but he was George's right-hand man and just a bigger character than life. Somehow he liked us, turned us on to Mojo Buford for one of our first recordings as a harp player who at that time had already done some work with Muddy Waters. Yeah, somehow the Garrett thing just happened. I believe Garrett actually started with the Trashmen. Well, I'm not sure he started with them, but Garrett developed through his affiliation with Amos Heiliker, which later became Amos spelled backwards, Soma Records. That whole development thing just sort of, again, it's like the Accents for me. Osmosis, an osmotic process of one kind or another.
Okay, and your first single is Why, a cover song by Lonnie Mack. What's the story behind that recording?
Back then, there was very little to pick from. So you wanted to pick very carefully and find those artists that most affected you emotionally. And certainly the first time we heard or saw Lonnie Mack on TV, that was stellar in its effect. And that's why I think that so much affected the choices we would make over the next few years.
Was the Lonnie Mack version of Why being played on local radio?
You know, I believe it must have been. Otherwise, I don't know how the hell we would have heard it.
And Garrett approaches you and says, let's go in and do a record?
You know, back then, I think more the way this happened was the band developed favorite songs or conceptual ideas about, man, I wish we could record this. And then we would approach the promoter and say, hey, can you get us in the studio? We really like to do this. We think we can do it.
And the studio you went into to record Why was which studio?
Back then it was called K-Bank.
Do you recall who the engineer was?
Yes, Tom Jung, who later went on to become literally nationally famous as an engineer.
And I assume George Garrett was there?
Oh, yes.
Was he instructing the band along the way on...
George was kind of a character. He didn't have a lot to say. Didn't even grin a lot. He kind of... Tony Kyre again comes into the picture. He kind of was George Garrett's mouthpiece to some degree.
So Tony Kyre was there during the recording then.
Tony, yeah, would often give us input.
Okay. You record Why, and the B-side is Roadrunner. So Why comes out on Banger, the Garrett label. What happens when the record comes out? Did you get any airplay?
Yes, we actually did. It's very surprising in that time frame when you're probably driving your first reasonably good car to turn on the radio and hear yourself on it, because back then there was no such thing as tape or delayed or anything like that. It was, man, when it was on the radio, you were on the radio and everybody heard it. And when you heard yourself on the radio, oh, what a flattering feeling.
I assume this must have helped the band in their popularity.
Immensely, and financially.
So your price went up.
Oh!
Who was booking the band?
I was, at that time.
You were, okay. Were both WDGY and KDWB on it?
You know, I really didn't listen to KDWB. They were kind of the B station at that time.
Did you get invited to Ouija to do an on-the-air?
A number of times.
What was that like?
Neat. I mean, when you're a 15, 16-year-old kid and you're in a radio station, it's tantamount to your first sexual experience.
Now, George Garrett also had a record store, correct?
Correct, he did, on Lake and Nicollet.
And that was Nicolake Records?
Correct.
Did you guys hang out there?
Oh, yes.
Obviously, he had your record for sale there.
Oh, yes.
Did it sell well, do you know?
I have no idea. I have never received a penny in royalties from anything I've ever recorded.
Now, I recall a prior conversation that I had with you, and you related to me a story about the Accents performing Why at Mr. Lucky's, resulting in numerous female members of the audience actually crying. Is that true?
Only because they had dated me.
Is that what happened, really?
It was emotional, yes.
All right, so your second 45 comes out, and what's on that 45?
It's an old tune by the Coasters called Searchin'.
All right. And the flip side was apparently, it looks like an original song.
Written by our drummer, lead singer, Tommy Nystrom. And it was called You Don't Love Me.
All right. And that comes out again on Banger. Did Searchin' also receive airplay? Like, why?
It did.
And again, adding to the band's popularity?
Correct, and price.
And price goes up again. You're kind of on a roll here on your first two records.
Hey, for a kid who's a junior in high school, I was doing okay.
Do you recall what the band got paid for a typical performance, roughly?
You know, it's odd. Just before this interview, I was going through some old records. Not records, but some old receipts of contracts. There were quite a few contracts where if we were contracted for five nights a week at a club, we were picking up $1,000. And this was in 1964.
That seems like a lot of money for 1964.
It was a boatload of money.
Were you able to buy cool cars?
Oh, we all had new cars.
Well, let's hear what. Who drove what?
Tom bought. They had just come out with the Plymouth Barracuda. Kenny bought an MGA. I bought an Austin Healey 3000 Mark III, and Skip bought a Thunderbird convertible.
Nice. Do you recall the first piano that you purchased?
The only one available. It was made by Wurlitzer, and it was called their electronic piano.
Where did you buy it at?
Schmidt Music.
Remember the cost?
Under $500, I believe.
Okay. And did you upgrade by the time you were in the Accents to a different?
No, actually, there were no upgrades available. It was years before other manufacturers decided to pursue the electronic keyboard and develop products that were infinitely better.
Now, did this have a built-in speaker, or did you have it hooked up to a...
It had a built-in speaker that was about on a par with a large earphone, and then you had to use some kind of auxiliary amplification.
Okay. Speaking of band equipment, what were the other guys using as far as their musical equipment?
You know, back then, we all used magnetone amps. Just fantastic tube amplifiers, very unique sound. Kenny pretty much played a Fender, Skip played a Fender bass. Tommy used Rogers drums back then, still a fantastic set of drums, but I don't think they're manufactured any longer, nor have been since the 70s.